produced by Indie Media and available from all good podcast providers. You're listening to The Local Update. G'day, my name's Indie Wood. Thanks for joining me again this week. Coming up, we're going to talk eels with Tim Whittaker, a local eel expert in the making. IndieMedia.com.au is the place to go. You can find all the info you need about the local update, and me, of course, if you need to. Or you can submit story ideas there as well. If you've got an issue that you'd like talked about that's relevant to this local community in the Bega Valley, IndieMedia.com.au. Up first, though, as we do each week, we'll catch up with local icon, Mr. Graham Farram. This week, Graham Farram returns to his research on the history of newspapers in the Bega Valley, and he's gone back right to the start, to the mid-19th century, when the business district of Bega was in the development stage.
In 2014, the Bega District News issued a 150-year souvenir issue in which Alastair MacDonald, under the very biblical In the Beginning banner, introduces Robert William Sharp, a 19th century Bega brewer and entrepreneur. However, he states, the story of the Bega Gazette starts with a woman named Emma Otten, who for a considerable period of time was the only storekeeper in town, with a shopfront on the north side of the Bega River. After becoming Mrs. Robert W. Sharp, and moving her business to Auckland Street, her husband added largely to the stock and eventually started the Gazette and opened a dispensary under the management of W.H. Hopkins. A biography of Emma Otten is included in the 2012 Bega Valley Historical Society Incorporated publication, They Made This Valley Home, Stories of Pioneer Women Who Helped Build the Bega Valley, as told by Sandra Florence and Diane Pryor. Emma Otten was the eldest surviving daughter of John Otten and Patience Smallridge Otten. She was born in 1819 at Bridford, Devonshire, UK. Her father was sent out as a convict in 1830 when he was 41 years old. In 1833, he was working for Alexander Berry in Gerringong and was joined by his wife and their four surviving children. Whilst there, another two brothers and a sister were born. In 1842, a younger sister of Emma's, Sarah, married James Lang, possibly a relative of the Reverend Dr. J.D. Lang, who officiated. John, Patience, and their large family were brought to Bega by the Imlay brothers, who provided them with land and sheep to work for them in partnership. Bailey, writing in 1942, includes in his history of Bega a biography of Emma's younger brother, John Otten II. It states he was born at Jamberoo in 1836 and came with his English parents to Bega as a youth. They had their home at Yarranung when it was submerged in the flood of 1851, and that they took shelter in a shepherd's hut in the hills. In the early days, he was noted as a fine bushman and horseman of fine physique, and often had to face flood and bushfire, and that when he died in 1911, the funeral cortege was nearly a mile long. Young John Otten would have been about 15 at the time of the 51 flood, and his sister Emma about 32. On March 9th, 1857, an Illawarra Mercury correspondent reported, "There is a good opportunity for some party with capital to commence storekeeping in our town. It will be a safe and remunerative affair and a great accommodation to the district." That's Bailey quoting in his History of Bega. Soon after, in 1858, Miss Otten opened the first store at North Bega. They Made This Valley Home records that the store was near Samuel Mead's public house and opened on Christmas Eve, 1858. She provided essential goods to the pioneer settlers, the nearest store being at Maruya. Among the goods provided would have been the slops and sundries mentioned by Brain in his diary as being within the purview of the storekeeper. Sundry is an interesting word. My concise Oxford dictionary tells me it can be an adjective and a noun. As an adjective, it means various, several, as in all and sundry. As a noun, it is an Australianism, meaning an extra in cricket, and in plural, oddments, accessories or items not needing special mention. You could be a sundries man, a dealer in sundries. Comes from the old English. I had a vague idea what slops were, but I'm glad I looked that up too. So, slop, definition two, a noun, in plural. Workman's loose outer clothes, ready-made or cheap clothing, clothes and bedding supplied to sailors in Navy. You could be a slops seller or own a slops shop. I trace that to the Middle English, but there is a reference to offer slop, Old English for surplus. A little further down the page, we find sloppy and then sloppy Joe, a woman's loose sweater. In 1860, we find Emma as a storekeeper in Lower Auckland Street, South Bega. In that year, she marries a neighbouring businessman, Robert William Sharp, who was born in Lancashire and who had been a ship's captain. Her shop became incorporated with his businesses. In 1864, Bega's first paper, the Bega Gazette, was established by Robert in the premises known as the Post Office Stores, later known as Paternoster Row. The first edition was circulated on the 3rd of December, 1864. Bailey makes use of four quotes from the early Bega Gazette in his history of Bega. In chronological order, they are 1. 8th of the 8th, 1868. Through the exertions of individual enterprise, Bega is gradually assuming the proportions of a town. The education of the young is well cared for by the establishment of three public schools. The spiritual welfare of the people is well or better provided for as any town in the interior of the same population. But as for places of amusement and intellectual recreation, Bega is entirely destitute. We appeal to the people to liberally support the erection of the School of Art. 2. 3rd of October, 1868. Our little town, notwithstanding the dullness of trade, is, though slowly yet surely, progressing. Within the last 12 months, buildings have sprung up and population increased to an extent little dreamt of a few years ago. Although many of the structures are not of a permanent description, weatherboard, yet they are well built and ornamental to the town, adding largely to its picturesque appearance. However, there are a few substantial brick buildings erected or in course of erection. The commercial or billiards room, the property of Mrs. Anne White, is a neat, commodious, though plain brick building. It's quite finished and adds to the business appearance of Church Street. The Wesleyan Chapel, nearly finished, only requiring the eternal fittings, is a tasteful structure and the only brick house of worship in Bega. Mrs. Prescott's store, in course of erection, is also a brick building and will give a city appearance to that part of the township. Mr. Malcolm's store and Mr. W. Rickson's cottage are two well-built houses. The former is intended for a store. It has a fine, imposing shop front and balcony over it. The latter is a neat weatherboard cottage upon a stone foundation. Mr. W. Thompson has erected a weatherboard shop adjoining his store. It is to be occupied as a saddler establishment. There are several other buildings about to be commenced, among which we may mention the School of Art, a large store opposite, and a dwelling house for the Church of England School. Bega at present represents a bustling appearance, and however bad the times may be for storekeepers and farmers, tradesmen cannot complain. New Year's Eve, 1868. Bailey records that bushfires had ravaged the whole of the surrounding district on Christmas Day, 1868. The Gazette wrote of the town's progress for the year. Starting at Auckland Street, we noticed the erection of extra rooms at the public school, a new store for Mr. Ellis, and additions to the Gazette office. Round the corner into Bega Street, a large butcher's shop for Mr. Underhill. In Church Street, we find a substantial brick cottage, at present occupied as billiards room and old Oddfellows Hall. Additional rooms to Mrs. Anderson's and Sattler's, and houses and stores upon Mr. Byrne's premises. Next comes the house and butcher's shop for Mr. Biller. And on the other side, the residence for the teacher of the Church of England School. As we reach Cart Street, we observe a whole nest of buildings completed or in progress. A large frame store and dwelling for Mr. Thompson, Mrs. Myers Sattler's shop, the School of Art, and on the opposite corner of Gibbs Street, a fine piece of business for Mrs. Prescott. Turning to the right, descending Gibbs Street, we find Mr. Malcolm's store, a cottage belonging to Mr. Byrne, and over the way, two frame cottages, the property of Mr. Gleeson. Whilst higher up the hill stands the nearly finished Wesleyan Chapel. 4. 27th of the 5th, 1869. The following advertisement appeared in the Gazette. John D. Manigan, General Letter Writer, Gibbs Street, Bega. Bailey notes that illiteracy was still common, and the bench book of the Bega Courthouse has marked signatures. And on page 47, as late as 1880, a petition was signed by 147 persons, 34 of whom made their mark. In July 1869, Robert sold the Bega Gazette to Tyrone White, but already in 1868, he had sponsored the Southern Standard newspaper, which began in opposition to the Gazette. They made this Valley Home Records. Robert and Emma Sharp moved to Candlow in 1872, a progressive village destined to be the largest town in the Bega Valley, and opened the first store there. Robert died in Candlow 2 years later, in 1874, and Emma remained with her four sons, William, Robert, Jack and Sam, and died there on the 6th of September 1885, aged 66, still running the store and raising a family alive. She did not remarry. The death notice in the Bega Gazette is very brief. On Sunday evening last, Mrs. Sharp, relict of the late R.W. Sharp, one-time proprietor of this journal, departed this life at her residence. And then on the 9th of September 1888, this might have had something to do with celebrating the centenary, an obituary appeared in the Bega Gazette and says in part, "Soon again we have to report the decease of an old resident in this district, Mrs. Sharp, widow of the late R.W. Sharp, who founded the Gazette in Bega, passed over to the silent shore on Monday night, aged 67. Between 25 and 28 years ago, somewhere about the time that the old St. John's Church was built, when the family hotel was kept by John Needham, Mrs. Sharp, who was then Miss Otten, began a business and for a considerable period was the only storekeeper in Bega, in a building on the north side of the river, not far from Mead's Public House, which was opened on Christmas Eve, 1855. I've mentioned Sam Mead's Public House a couple of times. It was called the Traveller's Rest Inn and was located near Pope's Hole in Bridge Street, North Bega. That's from Bailey's History of Bega, pages 21 and 22. Sharp Street, Sharp with an E, is the main street on the western side of the Candlow Creek in Candlow there, and I assume it was over there that they had their shop. That road eventually turns into the Megilla Road if you're going north, or the Myrtle Mountain Road going south. There's a branch off onto the Tantawangla Road there too. So that's good. That was my wife who said, "Oh, don't you remember Sharp Street, mate?" Well, I used to live out that way in a place called Fernlee. It was on Bollers Road. It was the last house on Bollers Road, which was a very soon turn off on the Tantawangla Road coming off the Megilla Road. I had been looking around the house and I found this excellent little book. I've got it in my hands right now. It's humorous verses by Henry Lawson, published by Angus and Robinson, by one in 1931, but first published in a platypus edition in March 1924, which means 2 years after Lawson's death. And there's no introduction. Everybody's meant to know exactly who this bloke is. I've got the sixth platypus edition, December 1931, and thanks to very, very faded rubber stamp inside the front cover and the back cover, I'm told that it at one time belonged to the public school at Tarpa. Certainly being read through, it's one of those books you can tell it falls open at night, 1931. It could be at Meade's public house. Write it down for me. This is on pages 189. In the parlour of the shanty where the lives have all gone wrong, when a singer or reciter gives a poem or a song, where the poet's heart is speaking to their hearts in every line, till the hardest curse and blubber at the thoughts of Auld Lang Syne. Then a boozer lurches forward with an oath for all disguise, with a soul where prayers and curses bring the liquor to his eyes, grasps the singer or reciter with a death grip by the hand. That's the truth, bloke. Sling it at him. Oh, God blimey, that was grand. Don't mind me, I've got him. You know. What's your name, bloke? Don't you see? Who's the bloke that wrote the poetry? Will you write it down for me? And the back block bard goes through it, ever seeking as he goes for the line of least resistance to the hearts of men he knows. Yes, he tracks their hearts in nature, and he tracks them out alone, seeking for the power to sway them till he finds it in his own, feels what they feel, loves what they love, learns to hate what they condemn, takes his pen in tears and triumph, and he writes it down. We're sort of getting over the isolation. I've been enjoying it, giving me an opportunity to do things that normally get taken up with other things. The museum, I can't wait for it to open again. But here's one that I've got, sort of isolation. This is from page 85 of the Humorous Verses. It's called Down the River. I've done with joys and misery, and why should I repine? There's no one knows the path but me and that old dog of mine. We camp and walk and camp and walk and find it fairly good. He can do anything but talk, and wouldn't if he could. We sit and thinks beside the fire, with all the stars ashine, and no one knows our thoughts but me, and that there dog of mine. We have our Johnny Cake and Scrag, and finds them fairly good. He can do anything but talk, and wouldn't if he could. I has my smoke, he has his rest, when sunset's getting dim. And if I do get drunk at times, it's all the same to him. So long's he's got my swag to mind, he thinks the times is good. He can do anything but talk, and would if he could.
Graham Farram was previously the proprietor of Mumford's Books here in Bega. He's a local artist, a long-term member of the community, and for a while now he's been a bit of a history buff that is associated with the Bega Pioneers Museum. And we catch up with him every week to find out what little tidbit he's found from the history of the region. For all of us in life, there's an event that triggers an interest that will change the rest of your life. For local lad Tim Whittaker, that event was accidentally capturing an eel in a yabby trap in the Bega River off Gilla Flats. That random interaction with an eel piqued an interest that led him to research eels from all over the world, find songs, poems, and stories written about the critters, and even start a local radio show that focused solely on eels. I caught up with Tim Whittaker recently.
Hello, my name's Tim Whittaker, and I have a fascination with eels, the freshwater variety belonging to the genus Anguilla.
that's a good spot to start. Where did this fascination come from?
Well, it was just by chance. I actually, while I was renting a property in between house moves at Jillajilla, I happened to accidentally catch an eel in a yabby trap. And I sort of, that started me thinking, well, gee, what are these creatures, what are they about? So that started the research. And the more I dug into some facts about this mysterious creature, the more fascination was activated, and I just kept going and going from there.
Is there something unique about the eels specifically in this region?
Well, there's the Jillajilla in this region is renowned for a lot of eels. The eels, all eels are spawn in the ocean and live most of their life in fresh water, which is the reverse of most type fish. The eels here that travel up to the Brogo River and often get trapped in the Brogo Dam. There is actually a ladder installed for the little elvers when they're swimming up to the fresh water to climb up and get into the Brogo Dam. But unfortunately, they get big ones get trapped in there, so they can't get back out to the ocean to spawn.
What kind of numbers are we looking at? Are they threatened in any way or anything?
Overall, the numbers are in decline, some areas quite dramatically, because of their quite extraordinary migration that they go through and their breeding habits. They're open to all sorts of human impacts and changes in the environment. Like hydroelectric dams are one of the big threats. It stops them going up and living in the normal areas they would get to, and also trying to get back out to the sea to spawn. Pollution and changes in water temperature and currents in the ocean, because they do travel quite some distance to get to the spots where they spawn in the ocean. So, yeah, all those things have a contributing factor, and there's been a lot of effort, especially overseas, in working out ways they can assist the eels in getting the numbers back up.
I guess I've always assumed that fish of any kind are either freshwater or saltwater. Is it unique that they start their life in one and move into the other?
Yeah, this it's called catadromous, where they live in freshwater. For example, salmon live in the ocean and then come into freshwater to spawn. They're anadromous. The catadromous eels, it is quite unique. They go through about five different changes in their appearance or metamorphosis stages from when they're first hatched in the ocean, and where they're tiny glass eels and float on the current, back when they turn into elvers and then go up to the rivers, and then they finally change again when they go out to spawn to adapt to that change from freshwater to saltwater. Some of those changes include quite dramatic changes where their mouths fill up and they don't eat and the European eels, Anguilla, often travel up to 3,000 kilometres to get to their spawning areas in the Sargasso Sea without eating. So it's an incredible journey, and there have to be very adaptable changes in not only appearance but changes in their whole body to make that extraordinary migration happen.
I made an assumption before. I referred to them as a fish. Are eels actually fish?
They are a fish. There's lots of different species of, or there's lots of, for example, electric eels aren't eels, moray eels aren't eels, or what they call true eels. They're all fall into the classification of anguilliforms. When we're talking about eels, we're talking about the 20-odd varieties belonging to this genus Anguilla. There's actually about four species in Australia, Anguilla australis, the short-finned eel, Anguilla reinhardtii, the long-finned eel, and there's a couple of other, Anguilla obscura and Anguilla, name seeks me, they're up in northern Queensland, right over in the top of Western Australia. But the main two species in Australia are the short-finned and long-finned eel. But there's about 20 species around the world which are the true eels belonging to that species Anguilla.
For someone who've just found one in a trap at some point, you certainly seem to know a lot. What do you do with this research?
Well, I sort of collect information, and one thing leads to another. I used to do a radio program all about eel, where I played the music and had eel facts. I collect eel poems, and your good friend and my good friend Graham, we often get together and recite eel poems. Eel music, I've got some collection of eel music, and eel paraphernalia and all sorts of things I collect. But probably what fascinates me the most is eel's connection with the human race. And there's been a long association and quite interesting connections between eels and humans. One right back to Aristotle, who first words that were recorded talked about, because they couldn't see where the eels spawned and laid their eggs, they just assumed that, in his words, they were a spontaneous creation from the entrails of the earth, which is quite an interesting thing, because they couldn't do that. Even the great psychiatrist Sigmund Freud, he, in his early days when he first left university, his job was to try and find identify the sex organs of eels, of course, who are not mature when they're in fresh water. So he spent up to many hours dissecting eels in that fruitless search in a dark, dank cellar in Geneva before he gave up on that and tried his hand at psychiatry. So who knows? Without eels, we would not probably have had the benefits of his great insights into psychiatry.
So what about these days? Like, short of stumbling upon one in a trap, what do we do with eels these days?
What do we do? Well, it's interesting. Australia, interesting, hasn't got really much of a great love of eels or as a culinary dish. But overseas in Asia and Japan and Europe and England, there's many people there who really like eel, and it's quite a big business. In fact, there's in America where they, in Japan, they've actually fished the native species, Anguilla japonica, there. So they actually import a lot of elvers from places like America and other areas and raise them in fish farms. Because of that unique migratory habit, they cannot breed eels in captivity. So they have to capture the baby eels and then raise them to satisfy that demand for people who really like eating eels. And I can probably not recognise in Australia, but probably top chefs around the world would put eel in one of the top smoked fish variety. It's probably even a number one. A smoked eel is the best smoked fish you can get.
Have you got a poem or a story or something you'd like to read us out of your collection at the moment, Tim?
Yes, this is by the great Ogden Nash, who did quite whimsical type of poetry, and his poem, The Eel. I don't mind eels except as meals and the way they feel. Short, but that can be a poem by Ogden Nash. But there's plenty, many... some great, recognised as great literacy works, actually. There's a whole series of poems concerning eels.
Very good. All right, well, we might have to get you and Graham together at some point and get you to have a bit of a play with some of them, huh?
Oh, that'd be great. I'd love to do that. I always like Graham's company, but he's helped me along the way in finding bits and facts about eels as well, so it's great to get together and talk about eels or recite about eels.
Tim Whittaker is a local eel expert based here in the Bega Valley. This is The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues, events and personalities from around the Bega Valley. Available from indiemedia.com.au and from anywhere that you get all good podcasts. Thanks again to guest Tim Whittaker and, of course, to regular contributor Graham Farram. If you're after more info on any of my guests, or if you want to listen back to previous episodes, you can do all of that on indiemedia.com.au. If you're listening to The Local Update on the website, then thank you. But don't forget, you can also check us out wherever you get your favourite podcasts. And if you're listening on iTunes or any of the other podcast providers, why not take the opportunity to offer a review, some feedback, or comments on episodes? Offering feedback and reviews sees my podcast pushed up the ratings in the iTunes podcast list, and hopefully means more listeners. My name's Indy Wood, and I'll leave you this week with this because it's just too good an opportunity not to. Bye now.
Eels up inside ya, find it an entrance where they can. Eels up inside ya, find it an entrance where they can. Pour it through your mind, through your tummy, through your anus. Eels. 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 Eels.
Staggering about on me old man's feet.
I have one foot in the grave.
Go down the rain. Go down the rain. It's a mashup.
Oh, I'm
a mashup. Elements of the past and elements of the future are coming at ya. From the inside, let me put you in the picture.
Elements of the past and the future combining to make something not quite as good as either.